people have a tendency to quiet down.
Yeah.
You ever notice that?
Diagnosis food.
When there's quiet.
What does it eat?
H1, H3, H3N2, or H5N1.
So it must be true.
Well, H5N1.
But obviously she's in there.
I gotta get home so I can watch.
I think
so
we're
speed it up.
Obviously those that are in attendance are expecting something to happen here in the next.
Mr. Chair, are we having a meeting today?
Yes, we are. Let me call the meeting to order, the meeting of the Environmental Quality Board to order. Why don't we take a look at the agenda, and I would welcome a motion to approve the agenda.
Second.
There's a motion. Is there a second? There is a second. Further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion carries. Introductions. Let me be the first to welcome Assistant Commissioner Naramore, and it's a little hard for me to spit that out because I've been working with Barb for the past couple of years. Barb has been, as I said, the long-serving and long-suffering Executive Director of the Upper Mississippi River Basin Association. And one of the duties and responsibilities of the chair of the Environmental Quality Board is to serve as the governor's representative on the UMRBA, Upper Mississippi River Basin. That is created by five governors in 1980. At that time, obviously an interest in making sure that we dealt with the Upper Mississippi River Basin in a very positive manner. And Barb has led that organization for many, many years. I was fortunate enough to spend the last couple of years working with her. And so now she has stepped a long way down the career ladder to become a member of the, I'm kidding, up the career ladder to become the assistant commissioner over at the Department of Natural Resources, and Barb is here today to represent DNR at the table, and I want to warmly welcome you to your new position, Barb, and you will be sorely missed. I'll be leaving on Friday, I think, or Thursday of next week to I had two options. One was to travel, and you'll appreciate this, with the governor to Oslo for 4 or 5 days in Norway, and the other was to drive to Davenport for the UMRBA meeting. I want you to know that I opted for Davenport. Welcome, and we're going to have a tough time struggling along with UMRBA without your knowledge base and your affection for the Upper Mississippi River. So, Barb, thank you so much for being here, and welcome to the Environmental Quality Board, where there is just a whole lot of fun things going on here.
Well, gosh, thank you. Barb, very kind welcome.
Well, give us a little background if you wish. And
you've given ample background, I'm sure, for everyone here. But I did want to just send Commissioner Landwehr's apologies for not being here. We have our Senate budget hearing this afternoon, so as you can imagine, that is where he is.
All right. Wonderful. Well, welcome. Kate, you want to introduce yourself?
Kate Knuth, citizen member of the board.
I'm Eric Tomlinson, citizen member.
And Mike Rothman, Commerce Commissioner.
Bob Patton, Executive Director.
Dave Fredrickson, Commissioner of Ag and Chairman of the Board.
I'm Leah Hedman. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the EQB Board.
I'm John Stein. I'm the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency.
Kristen Weeks-Dunkinson, citizen member from Southern Minnesota.
John Saxhaug, citizen member from Minneapolis.
Brian Napstead, Chairman of the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health.
Very good. Jim, you want to start with yourself?
Jim Urkel with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy.
Welcome.
Lee Helgen, Executive Director of Envision Minnesota.
Kate Prince, EQB staff.
Deborah Moynihan, MnDOT Technical Representative.
Susan Heffron, technical representative for the PCA.
Susan Medhaug, tech rep for the Department of Commerce.
Randall Doneen, tech rep for DNR.
Jeff Smizer with the EQB.
Lisa Agramonte, Council for Xcel Energy.
Molly Smith, Council for Xcel Energy.
Travis Germanson, tech rep for the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Becky Balk with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Helene Johnson with GTS Educational Events.
Ellen Anderson with Commissioner Fredrickson's office, Governor's office, and EQB.
Anna Sherman with Department of Ag and EQB.
Thanks so much, and welcome to all of you. And a wounded Jeff back there, welcome back. I see you must be stepping to the background, and Kate's going to pick up the job up here for you. All you have is a wound in your shoulder. I didn't realize that surgery extended to your brain.
As your attorney, we're on.
Oh, we're on, yeah. All right, that's right. Okay, all right. Oh, can't they take a joke? Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, welcome back from your surgery, Jeff. Good to see you out and about. And the attorney just advised me to zip it, Scott. So I will. The chair's report basically centers around the events of yesterday. Many of you were there and participated. It was the joint hearing of the House and the Senate Committee on the Environment. Senator Marty chaired the hearing. It was an overflow crowd. They moved it to room 123, and 107 was the spillover. Both rooms were absolutely packed. Commissioner Stein, myself, MnDOT, and let's see, DNR. Health, Aggie was there, and DNR was there to testify. EQB led off with a testimony, and basically my testimony was giving them basically a timeline of what we had done and the engagement that the Environmental Quality Board had with the whole issue of frac sand mining, that the governor was, in fact, interested in, because we were got very close to the time the legislature would convene, that the governor was interested in making sure that all parties were engaged and that the legislature would have an opportunity to lead on this also. And we went through, I think there were 41 testifiers, about a little over half, John, were able to have their opinions and thoughts heard, both from an industry perspective and from a citizen's perspective. John, you were there and testified on behalf of MPCA, and Brian was in the audience. Ed Aggie was there and did an excellent job of presenting from the Department of Health's perspective. Do you have any comments you might want to add?
Well, I thought the hearing was a great opportunity for people to express their views. I know that the industry representatives were appreciative of getting the opportunity to present as well as citizen perspective. I thought there were significant concerns from the local governments that came forward, too. There were a handful of either county commissioners, township officials, or city council members who presented and spoke to a level of concern that I think it's been presented here before the board previously, that there are some challenging decisions before local governments that they don't feel fully equipped to make. They're seeking additional support and information both from the project proponents as well as state agencies. So I was interested by that we had really a wide scope of commentary from all perspectives, but I was struck by the local governments asking for more guidance, technical advice, and support. I was also noted that the industries that presented are largely the industries that are not proposing expansion of mining operations in southeastern Minnesota. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of those that presented were the existing facilities, mostly in along the Minnesota River Valley, which have had a long-standing mining establishment in the in the state. So that was also interesting to me about kind of who's there and who's not was informative. So I thought it was very thorough. I stayed for the entire hearing so I could understand where people were coming from.
As did I, only in the anteroom of 107. Brian had a spot behind the cameras, I noticed. Any comments, Brian?
I would concur with the comments that you've made, Mr. Chair, as well as Commissioner Stein's comments. We do have some challenging decisions. I guess the one thing I would add is the level to which I appreciate walking into that hearing with background knowledge. EQB staff and agency staff have done a really great job of bringing this board up to speed with regard to the issues surrounding silica sand mining. I had gone there with the intention of getting a flavor for what the individuals who live in the area feel regarding sand mining. Clearly, I was able to obtain that input, but I thought I might learn some new technical information as well. And given the fact that really we've been briefed pretty well, I was very satisfied that we have a good foundational basis to begin making decisions from. It's pretty clear that the legislature is going to be discussing this further, and depending to the extent upon which they wish to give us guidance, we'll be making decisions from there.
We haven't seen a bill yet, but my assumption is that there will be one drafted shortly, and we'll be able to react to that one way or the other. But a shout-out, obviously, to those that work so hard to prepare the documents to put in front of this board. Thank you all for that work. Any other comments regarding the hearing yesterday? If not...
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I guess I would be curious in terms of the EQB. Was anything said about the EQB's role?
I was listening very intently to see if we were going to be criticized in any way, shape, or form, and the good news is that we were not. There was praise for the letter that Commissioner Ellinger and Commissioner Stein put forward, and I compliment both of you for the leadership that you put out there. That was very positive, and there was no criticism of the board. Given the fact that we have a slim staff, we're able to put, I think, a lot of time and effort into the silica sand mining issue, and absolutely no concern or comments to the contrary, John. So I was pleased with that.
Mr. Chair, just one. A number of testifiers, especially citizens, asked for a generic environmental impact statement and a statewide moratorium. There were a number of specific comments made in citizen testimony to that point. The industry and others alluded to there's sufficient regulatory structure in place and that a GEIS would not be beneficial. So there was, I'd say if you're counting, there are certainly more people asking for a GEIS and a statewide moratorium, or a state moratorium, I should say, than saying don't do that. But, I think that had to do with who was on the list to testify. But that was just sort of a, if you're keeping track of the number of statements that were made.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on. Bob, the Executive Director's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one item, and I did not jump fast enough when you adopted the consent agenda to possibly add the agenda item of election of a new chair.
That's correct.
Vice
chair.
Vice chair, excuse me. Not.
You can, that's open. Yeah, that's totally open. Yeah.
So we were staff actually reminded me that we're required by rule to do that in February.
We are still in February. So why don't I then open up nominations for the vice chair? The current vice chair is none other than Brian Napstead, nominations are now open for the vice chair of the Environmental Quality Board.
Mr. Chair, I would nominate Brian Napstead for vice chair.
Brian Napstead has been nominated. Are there other nominations? Are there other nominations? Are there other nominations? Hearing none, I would ask for someone to cast a unanimous ballot in favor of Mr. Knapstad.
I second the nomination.
All right. And Ed seconds. All of those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. Congratulations, Brian, on your second term as the vice chair of EQB.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your presence makes the job very easy.
Well, I'm getting old and I might get sick.
Don't do that.
All right. Ellen, update on the Environmental Congress?
No, I'm done.
Okay.
Yeah, we just...
We're ready.
Oh, you have nothing. So I don't need... All right.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to start. I just wanted to say three quick points about the silica sand issue, just to follow up on the discussion. One is that there is a hearing scheduled next Tuesday, the 26th, in Senator Marty's committee to take up silica sand bills. So we expect bills will be introduced, obviously, before then. So stay tuned on that. Secondly, in terms of coordination, I should just point out that legislative liaisons from a number of different agencies and governor's staff all worked together with EQB staff to make sure we had a coordinated presentation at the hearing. And so that was part of it. Really, there was a lot of work to have the EQB and the commissioners and the representatives of the agencies have sort of a coordinated message. So that was really well done, and I wanted to commend people for that. And various senators have been asking us for advice about how to proceed on this issue, recognizing that the EQB and the agency staff have spent quite a bit of time exploring this issue, and they're looking to us for expertise. So I just wanted to point that out. And specifically, there's been some questions beyond the items that you mentioned, Commissioner Stein. People have been asking about how the EQB can have oversight over these issues, so in terms of environmental review. So just something that's being discussed.
So be careful what you ask for.
So, yeah, there's that. And related to that, maybe I'm going to mention one other thing and then get to the Congress. And this was at the end of my comments, but it just follows on what that discussion was and what Commissioner Knapstad said, which is at the last hearing a month ago, some of you asked for getting more updates about what's going on related to silica sand mining. And I finally have an intern who's going to be devoted just to that issue, who's going to track media and meetings and legislative activity. And he's not here today, but he's just starting this week. Another intern, he's a Hamline University political science major, and so he's close by, and he comes highly recommended. And his name is Noah. And I just wanted to ask, just generally, you know, do you want to get regular email updates about this issue? There's been a lot of, it's risen to the level where it's on the front pages. So, for example, the letter that the commissioner sent, Commissioners Ellinger and Stein sent out, that was front page news in the Star Tribune last week, so I assume most of you saw that. But I don't want to send too much information. And so maybe what I'll do, you don't have to answer right now, I'm just alerting you that I'll send out an email soon to board members asking if you want kind of a weekly update on media coverage of the issue, that sort of thing.
I would say yes.
Yeah, okay. And you can
there
always...
There is that delete button, you know, so if you don't want it, you can hit delete. You know.
Sounds good. Unless someone says otherwise, that's what we'll do.
Yeah, and Ellen, I would say just weekly is about right. I would say if it were more frequent, I don't think it would help tell the story. Maybe it'll become necessary to be more frequent during the session as things unfold. But for the start, I think a weekly update would be great.
Sounds good. All right, great. We'll do that. And so we're going to give you a Congress update. And since this is the last EQB meeting before the Environmental Congress, we wanted to make sure we put it at the beginning of the agenda to make sure we have enough time to give you a full update on what's happening. And I wanted to start by introducing Helene Johnson, who is our event planner. And so Helene just wanted to come and say hello.
Welcome, Helene.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to just
first of all, say I'm delighted to be involved with the Congress and to work with all of you, and to just tell you a little bit about my organization, because I think we work with almost all your agencies, and you may not be aware of that. Our origin was as Government Training Service, and we were a joint powers organization. So the state was one of those powers with two agencies that were part of our governing board. We were also cities, counties, townships, schools, and the higher education institutions. And so we've been intergovernmental for our whole existence up to the point of 2004, where we became a nonprofit. And we are, our official corporate name is Government Training Services, Inc. We are going by GTS Educational Events because it says more of what we do, which is conferences and workshops and so forth. And our focus is on enhancing the ability for people in government to make decisions, but also to help them work with the other sectors, because obviously government cannot do it themselves. So I think that we're a good partner, and I'm pleased to have this opportunity.
Thank you. Questions for Helene at this time, or Ellen, are you going to
give us some updates. And
stay at the table? Okay.
Yep, and I think Helene won't be able to stay.
Right.
She has another obligation.
My board meets this afternoon at 2 o'clock. So.
But we just wanted to connect the name and the face, and she's been getting very, very busy. So she's doing tons
questions
of work.
Questions for Helene before she exits? If not, thank you, and it's a great pleasure to have you working on this process. It makes these two's life and consequently
hopefully,
mine a whole lot easier. So thank you.
Thank you.
I am eternally in your debt.
Thanks, Helene. Great, and we'll have Anna Sherman come up, too, in case I need help answering questions. So we're just going to give you an update on where we're at. So just to start with the objective and the outcomes, and this is very much similar to what you saw a month ago. It's been just slightly revised based on the conversation we had last month about our objective of the Congress to engage citizen leaders of Minnesota in refining and prioritizing citizen input, which will help guide the EQB in addressing Minnesota's present and future environment and energy challenges and opportunities. And the desired outcomes we're working towards are goals for the future. These are thinking about long-term goals that will help Minnesota achieve a long-term vision for the environment, and also in the shorter term, a narrowed down prioritized list of action items citizen leaders recommend to the EQB. So that's what's sort of driving our organizational principles as we move forward in planning. And so some really detailed updates I want to give you about where we're at in the planning. A lot has happened in the last month, and it's coming together miraculously. So March 15th, as you know, at the Ramada Inn in Bloomington, it's the former Thunderbird Hotel, which has been renovated, and we, those who have gone to visit it say it's looking very nice, and it's right next to the light rail transit, so it's transit accessible. The program, it's on a Friday from 8 to 5, and we want to make sure all of you have this on your calendar, because we'd like you to all be there, if at all possible. Based on your guidance, we've sent out invitations, and the invitations were sent out via email for the most part over a week or two ago, and we sent out invitations to over 400 people, and let me tell you the genesis of that list, because a lot of people have been asking. We started with suggestions from board members, and we got over 300 people recommended by different EQB commissioners and citizen members, and we took that list and got rid of duplicates, and then we filled in gaps. And so the gaps that we added to were to ensure we had geographic coverage, so it was somewhat balanced statewide. Diversity, we really tried to reach out to communities of color so that we would have more racial and ethnic diversity, and sector balance. So I can give you some examples of some of the people that I added were a long list of companies such as Ecolab Sustainability Director, Land of Lakes, Sagetis, BioAmber, Gevo, CHS, Mosaic, solar companies, the BioBusiness Alliance. So those are just some examples of some of the private sector companies we added and representatives. We added a number of people that participated in our environmental review focus groups, and a number of people that participated in our advisory group that oversaw the report card, that helped give us guidance on the report card. We added tribal leaders, and I believe we'll be sending a letter from the governor's office directly to tribal government leaders, just as a matter of courtesy, in addition to email invitations. I mentioned we've reached out in terms of trying to achieve more diversity, demographic diversity, than we had at the citizen forums, and environmental justice advocates, which tend to often be some of the same people in many cases. And we've had some really good help from some outside people. We've asked for advice about adding to that. We added legislators. We added members of the LCCMR and the Lisard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. And that's a quick list of a lot of the people that we added on. And so you can see, you know, the statute requires us to have a diverse group of people that participate in this from all different sectors and perspectives. And so this is how we're describing it now, as including environmental, conservation, agricultural organizations, chambers of commerce, scientists, and other experts, representatives from all levels of government, tribal leaders, leaders from business, student, and faith communities. So we've really broadened it to have it be a nice representative group of Minnesotans, and hopefully a fair and balanced group. We're doing our best, and, you know, it will never be perfect. So we sent out invitations knowing that not everyone would be able to come, and then anticipating that once we finalize the initial process of the invitation list and setting a deadline for people to respond, then we will open up all remaining spots to the public. And we think we'll have a significant number available for the public as well. So that will reach that balance, because there is as we all know, there's a big public demand to participate in the events that we've held so far. So around the first week of March, we'll announce once we have it all figured out. I don't know the exact date. We'll open it up to the public, and we'll let people know that and take registrations. Our goal is to have everybody register in advance via email. We are charging a $35 fee for the Congress. So it is a significant fee, but it's also fairly reasonable, given that you get meals covered with that. That doesn't cover the cost, obviously, of someone attending, but it does help defray the cost to a certain extent. We have a lower fee available for students. And we're aiming for 550 attendees. That's what the room can hold. And, you know, ultimately, we're going to have to let fire codes be our guide in terms of if we reach overflow capacity. So are there any questions about that? All right.
Ellen?
Yeah.
When you do open it to the public, will it be first come, first serve, or will you try to maintain that balance that you tried to attain earlier on in the invitations?
Ellen?
That's a great question, and we've been debating whether we should sort of do a lottery once we get a pool of people, or just have it be first come, first served. I think we're going to try to get a sense of how many people are trying to register. We'll take guidance on that.
What is the room size? I mean, what's the fire marshal say we can hold?
Well, if you're at round tables, 550 people.
550, and now, no opportunity for...
You could expand that if you put theater-style seating in and got rid of some of the tables. But, of course, that makes it more difficult, because that's where you're supposed to eat your lunch, and that also makes it harder to have group conversations. So that would be the ideal number, but there is some capacity to expand it. And ultimately, the room can hold a couple hundred more, but then everyone will be very, very crowded.
John?
Ellen, I just, in regards to your request for advice, you know, I think there's a potential that you'll get a significant number of applications from organized groups of people who are prepared to kind of self-nominate because they have an interest to have a large turnout. So I'd be really cautious about just first come, first serve. I think there's got to be some mechanism to address that reality, that it wouldn't be advantageous to have a significantly over-representation of some organized group, whether it's and it doesn't matter what perspective they bring to the table. I think the goal would be best served. The goals of the Congress will be best served by a diverse audience. So somehow having a means to address that would be my advice.
And, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, we could do that either by sort of selecting or by, you know, and require people to be, you know, when they register to say, are you affiliated with a group or, where do you work or whatever, because in many of them may be already represented by the leader of an organization and they just want to have more people from that particular organization. Or we could just do a random lottery and just say we're going to take the pool and just pick the first however many hundred we have spots for. So I think there's advantages and disadvantages in terms of we just want to make sure we're fair and that the public understands and supports what we do here.
Sure.
But I think you're absolutely right in terms of the goal of where we want to be.
Other questions for Ellen? Are we prepared to say, sorry, no more room in the inn and send people home?
Well, we have, you know, like I said, the big room has an absolute maximum capacity. We also have four breakout rooms, and the structure is set up to allow breakout. We're going to all get into the agenda in a minute about the breakout plan that we have. I mean, ultimately, you can crowd those rooms, too. And so I think you could expand this. You could include a lot of people. It wouldn't be ideal in terms of having the dialogue and the organizational structure we have in mind, but we can definitely accommodate a lot more than 550 people. But when each room is filled to the fire code, we're going to have to turn people away because that's a public safety issue, and we can't be jeopardizing the public safety. So that's the ultimate sort of limit, and that's a lot of people. I don't know the exact number, but we're going to have to enforce fire codes, bottom line, and beyond that. When we get to the issue of videotaping it, that's related, you know. We need to make sure we have another backup, you know, a plan B and a plan C, and we're trying to do that in whatever way we can.
John. Eric.
I guess that was going to be maybe my question. Maybe you'll address it when you talk about the video.
But yeah.
I looked into maybe a webcast or simulcast or something like that, and maybe the structure isn't conducive to do that if there are a lot of breakouts where it would be effective, but I was just curious.
Why don't I just finish the plan, and then we can follow up on those conversations, because that's very much on point. Let's see, what did I want to make sure I covered? Okay, so in terms of the program, here's what we have in mind, and we have a great teams of state agency people on our team who are working on planning this. So it goes, there's several dozen people that are involved in this. It's not just me and Anna and Bob and Jeff and Kate. It's many, many, many people, including some of the other staff in the room. So we do have Governor Dayton confirmed to give brief comments first thing in the morning, which is wonderful. We intend to have an overview briefly of the EQB and what it is and who they are, and again, a brief overview of the report card. And then we will have a report of the top findings of the citizen forums. And I should point out that we've had a staff team, including one of the interns that we got brought on board a month ago, to compile all the findings from the citizen forums and the online forums. And all of that data will be posted online any day now. It's almost ready. And Anna's trying to get that online in her spare time. So that'll be up soon. So we're going to have a report on what did we learn from the citizens in all these meetings and all the online comments, and try to, you know, organize it so we can pull out some key themes and top priorities that emerged from that. We're also going to have a report from the Next Generation Congress. And I know I've talked about this over the months, that we've asked some student organizations to organize a Congress to give us feedback about what their generation thinks. And they have taken that idea, and they have run with it, and it's very exciting. They are very excited, and they're working very, very hard. And they are having their Next Generation Environmental Congress This coming Sunday, the February 24th, at the University of Minnesota St. Paul campus, Anna and I will be there. And you're all really very welcome to drop in. They would be absolutely thrilled to see any of you, and we can send the information if you feel like spending part of your Sunday with a group of students. I will pass that on. We'll get you out an email today on that, on the time and place. And we've asked them to come and present to us at the Congress and tell us what their leaders have compiled from asking the same questions. They've asked for our polling questions that we used at the citizen forums, and they're polling the students. They have over 100 people registered for their conference already, so it'll be really exciting to see what they come up with. And they've taken this very, very seriously, and it's very exciting. So anything else about that? Oh, and today we had some Future Farmers of America young people visiting the Department of Agriculture, and they've been invited to participate, and Anna and Dave gave them a good pitch to participate on Sunday as well. So we encourage them to reach out to people just like we've reached out to people from different perspectives. So it's not just the people that they already know, you know? Try to broaden and have it be a nice, a more diverse group of voices at the table. So that'll be the morning, and then later in the morning, we do have breakout panels planned. And I should comment that in terms of these reports, we're going to ask some EQB members to play a role in presenting some of this information. So stay tuned. We'll be letting you know what we have in mind. So breakout panels, and these have really come together. We have four panels for the second half of the morning. Divided into four categories. We merged energy and air, we decided, and then water, land, and climate. We have three expert speakers lined up for each panel from different perspectives or different sectors to talk about, to react to the findings of the forums and what the citizens have said, and then to think about it in terms of future directions. And then we're going to have as much question and answer and dialogue as possible in to feed off of what those experts bring to the table. So that's the morning session. And then, we have lunch set aside for a keynote speaker. We've gone around and around about the keynote speaker. We've had the offer from the Governor's Institute to bring in a former governor, and we've also talked about should we have someone from Minnesota be our keynote speaker, and so we're still discussing that, and don't have an announcement to make right now, but if you have strong feelings or suggestions, we will always take those. And then in the afternoon is dedicated to guided discussion so that we can really try to have facilitated conversations with this really great group of people in attendance to help them further narrow down and prioritize their best ideas that have come out of all this information, all these inputs, and all the conversation. And then we'll have a plenary closing session. So that's all I know about the agenda. And then we'd love to have a reception. I'll get to that when we talk about the budget. So that's the the last two things I have are the budget, and maybe I should just finish the presentation and then we can discuss, because they're all sort of connected issues. So I had promised a budget update for you, and this is what we've got. If you look at the center column, that's the budget, which was an estimated budget for the whole executive order, which has been primarily the Congress, but not just the Congress. And we've pulled out just the items that relate to the Congress on this. So we're not including the focus groups for the environmental review process in this. But that was
No, that wasn't part of the budget.
That wasn't part of this budget. Okay, thank you, Anna. That's why I knew I needed you here. So, and she's the one who's taken accounting classes, so she did this nice budget spreadsheet. So the original budget that we ran by you in back in July was the center column of numbers, and then you can look at where we've ended up to date on the right column. So The listening sessions cost a little bit more than we projected, but given the remarkable attendance that we had, that's a small bump that we had to pay to move one venue and pay for some extra coffees and cookies and that sort of thing. So that number is a little bit higher, $29.55. The Congress itself, in terms of the venue and the food for the day, we had projected $10,000, and the total cost is $26,000, but with our fee, it's $14,000 net, or $14,000 is the fee revenue.
Sticking out of it, yeah.
I should have you present this, Anna. So we have $14,000, and so it's a net of about $12,000 cost. For the venue, including all the food. So it's a little bit bigger, again, reflecting the bigger attendance. And then the event planner, we're a little bit over that target with $99.40 instead of $8,000. The administrative assistant, you will see that is Anna Sherman and her time, which has been at, we've estimated about 10 months, or excuse me, 80% of her time has been devoted to the Congress, and she spent the other portion of her time working on general EQB issues, particularly silica sand mining issues, and other EQB assistance as needed. So that's been the biggest chunk in this, has been that staffing, which we're counting as part of this budget. The intern, I mentioned, this is the intern that we had to pay a stipend to, who's working on the processing of all the data from the citizen forums. That's the $23.40. We agreed to give a grant to the Next Generation Congress to help them defray their expenses for $500, which matches what the University of Minnesota gave them. We didn't have to pay for a graphic designer for the report card. The webinars, we didn't have to pay for those. Printing and office supplies, we had put a fairly large estimate on there of $12,000, and in the end, we've had two print runs of the report cards, and that was ended up at $44.15. We've had the graphic design was done in-house by Deed, and they did a wonderful job. The office supplies for the forum, so we ended up way under what our anticipated printing budget was, but we still have that $2,000 question mark is a guesstimate about what our remaining supplies and office materials will be for the Congress itself. But we have plenty of report cards left to bring to the Congress, so we don't have to run any more of those. So that's an estimate. I'm going through this in a lot of detail. I hope that's okay. Postage, we haven't used at all. Speakers, we don't intend to use any speaker budget. So far, we don't believe we'll need to. And then reception, we had put a placeholder in there of $5,000. We think we can do it for $2,500. It won't be fancy, but it will be food. And I think it would be really great at the end of this long day to have a gathering for people to come and have a snack for those who want to stay. And no alcohol can be served at this event because it's a state function, but there does happen to be a bar next door in case anyone wants to go partake on their own dime. So this would be the state reception would be for food and, you know, non-alcoholic beverages. So that's an estimate. We could do a fairly low-cost reception for, and we're estimated out of all these people, probably not all of them would stay for the reception. So, because it's going to be a long day. We're going to start at 8 a.m. So that's where we're at with this is, again, is an estimated budget. This is the best we can give you to date, but it looks like we're doing pretty well based on our original targets, and we have a little bit of leeway. So just
want to the $2,000 and the $2,500, that $4,500, is that part of the $58,000?
Yes.
So you've added that in. It won't be in addition. Okay.
We've added those in.
Okay.
But those are estimated numbers.
Correct.
But absolutely. Yep, we added those in. But what's missing completely is the videotaping thing. And it's turned out to be probably a lot more expensive than we thought. But again, part of our whole issue with trying to, you know, achieve that perfect balance between having key people, I don't want to say key people in the room, but having invited people in the room and having the general public participate and having as many people participate as possible, but having limited space. Having some sort of a video feed for the event would really help to allow more access and transparency for this event. We don't think it's realistic to have real-time broadcasting. As far as we know, we can't do that. To do really high-quality videotaping and broadcasting would be in the ballpark of $15,000 or $20,000, I think. Is that for real-time? I think that's what Dave Rahasselt had suggested from PCA. So what we're trying to do is find low-cost and no-cost options. And, you know, we think, and because the breakout sessions are going to be a big part of the substantive part of the day, we want to record all four of those breakout rooms. And it may not be ideal quality to have one person there, one student or one staff person with one camera. It won't be the highest quality, but we might be able to do that for a low cost. If we broadcast this on, if we post it on the internet, if we put it on YouTube afterwards, which would be great, we have to provide closed captioning so that we are make it accessible to people of all abilities, and that's by law. And that's estimated at $3,000. It could be more than that to convert the video to closed captioning. So I would say that the $4,500 that you see here is the very lowest cost option we could come up with to have some sort of video recording of the event and to post it online, but it wouldn't be posted real time. And Helene, we've asked her to explore all different options. She's been talking to all kinds of folks about what is possible in terms of videography. She is exploring the idea of using public access cable, and there's still some possibility of that, but we don't know. That might be our very best bet, but if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. It's a lot to ask for them to cover a whole day and all these different breakout sessions. You have to have a lot of equipment to do that. And undoubtedly, we would have to pay for some of that. So that is all I have to present, and I would really like feedback about that and to ask, you know, let me just finish by saying sort of the three things we're asking for feedback on in particular, but of course anything else you're welcome to, is if you have strong feelings about the keynote speaker, how you feel about a reception, and what you think about the videography issue.
Mr. Stein.
Helen, thank you. Great job, and appreciate all the detail. It's very helpful. On the keynote speaker, I don't have a strong opinion about that, so Governor from outside Minnesota that's done a lot of environmental work, setting goals, working toward moving people to achieve greater environmental goals, I think would be great if there were a well-known speaker of that caliber that would be interested in coming and giving a perspective about how important it is to aim and work together to achieve a goal. I think that would be very inspiring or interesting at the very least. Regarding the reception and the video, I think we should having the video seems like a very low bar from my point of view. You need to document what we do. Having a videotape documentation of it is appropriate. I think we should budget $65,000 total, and if that changes, I think we can. And I have a proposal when you're ready, Mr. Chair, about how the agency should divide up the costs.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions or comments or suggestions for Ellen? Kate?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the presentation. I'm excited about this, and we'll be at the Next Generation Congress for part of the day on Sunday as well. This partially goes to the reception, partially goes to the agenda, and I know it's having a set agenda and packing it in is important, but I think part of the power of this is to have hundreds of people who all might vaguely know each other, know of each other, be interested in working with each other to have some time to have it be a little more informal. And a reception, I think, is a really good way to do that, but you can also build in, you know, 15 minutes here or there in the agenda, giving the agenda a little bit more flex time as it's, I mean, we didn't see all those specifics, but I think part of the power of the Congress is having all of these people in the same place together for a day. It's a pretty rare, if not doesn't really happen in the state. So that would be one suggestion. And I don't know, in terms of the budget, I do think a reception or an invitation for people to stay, even if it's, you know, not fancy food, at least it indicates that people are going to stay. I think, and that's important to have that space for the people as well.
We, Mr. Chair, we do have breaks, morning and afternoon breaks, but absolutely, I agree with you. And it's a jam-packed schedule, and we could have easily done this in a day and a half, but so there's a lot there. So I think we hear that all the time, that events, the part of the events that people found the most valuable oftentimes is the breaks and the times they can network.
So are we having water and bread for the breaks?
No, there'll be coffee and rolls or something
and a prayer.
Like that.
All right.
Yeah. Coffee, no, that's rolls. Part of that budget. That's part of that $26,000. So per person. Now again, well, everybody has to pay $35, yeah. And that helps to defray that. But yes, you will be fed well during the day.
Good, Mike.
Ellen, you mentioned expert panelists. I wondered if you had those selected, if you have ideas, or if they're in place, maybe telling us who they might be or circulating their names.
Is it okay if I scoop myself here? I can tell you they're pretty much all set with the exception of maybe one person, so I can just probably rattle them off. So on water, we have Dr. Deb Swackhammer. We have... I didn't write these down. We have Dr. Peter Sorensen, who's the invasive species expert in Minnesota, who runs the Center at the University of Minnesota on aquatic invasive species. Deb Swackhammer is a preeminent scientist on water sustainability issues. And David Mingy, thank you, former congressman, former Court of Appeals judge. So really a great panel on water, who's also working on the Ag Water Quality Certification. Yeah. And, you know, has some agriculture background. So that's the water panel. On energy and air, we have Judy Poferl, the CEO of XL in Minnesota, NSP CEO. We have Michael Noble, the director of Fresh Energy. And we have Dr. Masoud Amin from the University of Minnesota, who's a national expert on energy infrastructure, smart grid, et cetera. It's funny. There was some tweeting going on during the State of the Union address when President Obama mentioned a self-healing grid, and apparently it was a whole national thing where there were all these tweets about people saying, what is a self-healing grid? And of course, being the energy geek that I am, I had to tweet, well, ask Dr. Masoud Amin, who I think, I don't know if he coined that phrase, but he's an expert in that field. Anyway. So let's see, climate, we have Dr. Mark Seely, very well-known climate scientist from the University of Minnesota Extension. Thank you. Shalini Gupta, who many of you know, she's a former member of the Next Generation Energy Board. She was at IATP and now has an organization called Center for Energy and something Democracy, CEED, do you remember the name of it? So, but she is very active in climate equity issues and has a lot of background and knowledge. And what's the third one? No, he's on land. We'll come back to
that. Will Steger.
Will, we have Will earlier in the day.
Okay. But he's not on the panel.
He's not on the panel, and I'm blanking. I'm sorry. I should have brought this list with me. I should have anticipated this question. Insurance industry. We have the insurance industry talking. Bob Johnson from the Minnesota, I forget the name of the trade association, talking about weather-related disasters in Minnesota and giving sort of an economic and business perspective on that risk issue. And then the last panel is land, and we don't have that one fully developed yet. So I know we have Lee Frelick, professor, another great respected scientist from the University of Minnesota, and Susan Haig, the chair of the Met Council.
Yeah. And we're working on
A farmer.
Tony
expert.
Thompson, a farmer from southwestern Minnesota, who's both an environment. Well, I mean, he's a
Nobel Prize winner.
You know Tony, yeah.
Yes.
So
I
don't know whether he's out of the country or out of the universe, but I can't reach him right now.
So that's our panelists. I think it's a really distinguished group of some of Minnesota's top experts. So I'm really excited about the lineup. I hope you like them.
Comments, questions, suggestions?
Sounds good.
Thank you, both of you.
Any other thoughts about the budget?
John,
or
do you have
any
some
other questions?
Ideas?
Well, Mr. Chair, assume we want to have a conversation right now about how to pay for it if we can, because it would be a little burdensome on you to have to do shuttle diplomacy among the agencies.
Never.
So let me
been
offer
a problem in the past, you know.
Let me offer this as a suggestion that the Ag Department not fund any of it, since it's carried the vast majority of the work of administrative support for the whole effort. So the Ag Agency has already contributed significantly to the work. Just hear me out.
I'm stunned.
that six agencies, transportation, DNR, PCA, admin, commerce, and the health department, support it at a full share. And then the Board of Water and Soil Resources carry a half a share, since the board is a small agency with a very small budget of administrative funds. So that would give six agencies one full share at about $10,000, and the board at $5,000. And that would generate $65,000.
None of this has been billed yet, has it?
So that ramps up the amount of money that you should. I mean, my sense of what your comments were earlier is that you're not real happy about spending the minimum amount of money on a video, and you think that extra $5,000 or whatever it would get us to a level where you could
have a respectable video. Have some budget, because you don't know what you're going to actually spend on a couple of these items yet. But I'm just looking at, you know, don't bare bones everything. You know, if there's a way that we can all agree, you know, for an extra $1,000, an extra $1,500, whatever it's going to be as agencies, we should just give you some latitude to decide and design how we want to carry it off. My concern about the video is I want to make sure that we have a video.
Yes.
Because there will be important information in the future that we'll want to be able to look back on and capture. So that would be my interest, is trying to do something that's modest but allows the staff to come up with a plan that they can implement.
Yeah, I like the plan. however, I would also commit the department to at least being there for up to 70. So if it goes beyond 65, the Department of Ag will be there for that extra $5,000, and we'll decide, you know, how you want to move those dollars around. But that should give us enough flexibility to put a good videotape together, and enough flexibility to get a little more than crackers and bread for the reception or something like that. Brian?
I'm just curious. I wonder if Commissioner Stein could be a little more clear on the use of the video. I'm hearing you say you want a higher quality video. Is it because you're looking at using it in a closed caption fashion for public broadcast, or more of just a historical record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
Commissioner.
Chairman Napstead, I think it's both. I think I want a decent video for the people who are not able to attend but want to get a sense of what happened at the Congress. I also think that if we get a little higher video, some of the speakers' remarks will be useful in future video that agencies or EQB or citizen groups could use to build a broader story of whatever comes of the Congress could then be, at least we'll have that decent video quality to rely on for the future. That's my interest, is because I think they're, I'm hopeful, I guess, that we'll have some meaningful conversation and that the presentations will be of that kind of quality that people will want to look back on them.
I asked that question, Mr. Chair, just for clarification for Ellen's sake, on how those funds would be utilized, what type of quality video we'd be looking for. I would concur. It's an important historical record. And if we're looking at just archiving this, that's one set of expectations, whereas utilizing it is a whole different set of expectations.
Other comments, questions? If not, a motion probably would be in order. Can you clearly state your motion?
My motion, Mr. Chair, is that we fund the Environmental Congress budget up to $70,000 total, with equal shares being provided by the Department of Transportation, the Department of Natural Resources, the Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Administration, the Department of Commerce, and the Department of Health, at $10,000 each, that the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Department of Agriculture would fund up to $5,000.
Mr. Chair, would deed be omitted on?
I left deed off, didn't I? Let's change that. I missed one. We don't want to leave one of our agencies
off.
And
I'm wondering about the citizen members.
Duncanson Growers would not be.
In kind?
In kind, yes.
Okay.
In
so,
kind.
So Mr. Chair,
that bring cookies, yeah.
I'll bring
Seven times whatever it takes to get to $60,000 and two $5,000 shares. That means your share and Mr. Knapsed's share bumped up in percentage slightly.
Okay. You've heard the motion?
I'll second that.
There is a second. Is there further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. All right. Thank you.
Thank you
very
much.
We're ready to go and
we're
money
done.
In the bank. So.
Very good.
Good
Thanks
work.
So much.
Yeah.
Thank you. We're looking
Let's,
forward to seeing you all there.
Try and get through the next issue, and this is the issue of designation of a responsible governmental unit for preparation of an environmental assessment worksheet for a proposed recreational development in Shoreland, i.e. the Living Word Bible Camp. Bob, are you ready to take the chair?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I need to pull up a visual aid here.
Bob talks to himself a lot.
I do.
He hasn't answered himself yet, though.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is a matter that has been before you before. You may remember that we heard testimony and a presentation and testimony on this in June. And this is a matter that was tabled because the case was appealed to, at that point, to the Court of Appeals, and the matter has now been settled, and so the matter is off the table and back before you. I'm going to go over this as briefly but still thoroughly as I can, because I think it's important for the board to understand this fully. I wanted to say that the parties in this matter, Itasca County, the neighboring landowners, and the proposer, their counsel were fully informed of this proceedings, sent findings of fact in time to meet rule requirements. And it appears, I have not had any communication back from any of the parties, and it appears that they have chosen not to attend today. So I'm going to try to go through this as best I can. I'll answer any questions that you may have, even those that might be better answered by the parties to this matter, because we do need to deal with this. As you may recall, this is the project in this is an environmental quality board matter. Excuse me. This is an environmental review matter, and what the request is a request to designate a new RGU or a different RGU. You have had these types of requests before you in the past. This one has to do with a proposed Bible camp on Deer Lake in Itasca County. And so this is a vicinity map. You can see it's north of Cohasset on the southeasterly shore of Deer Lake is the location. And it's a proposed Bible camp with items you would expect: a lodge, a chapel, an office, dormitories, an activity building, storage buildings, recreation facilities, outdoor facilities, and so forth. And so this is the location of the proposed site on the map showing its location on Deer Lake. I guess it looks. On this map, it looks more easterly shore of Deer Lake. And this is what the project site looks like as of the taking of this photograph. All of these graphics are from an EAW that was prepared in 2008, I believe, 2009. And so the site has currently four residential buildings, which is a house and three accessory buildings. And this is a site plan just showing the location of the buildings and roads, and there's a trail system as well. And that's the graphics that I provided out of the EAW. I go through the history. Our staff report essentially in the annotated agenda has a brief history that you've looked over. There are also the findings of fact, which go into a great deal more detail on the history. And I'm going to give a little bit more abbreviated history of this matter. This is a case where there was an appeal, or there was a petition for an EAW that went to Itasca County. The county initially denied the petition. That was appealed to court, and that decision to deny the petition was overturned, resulting in the county preparing an EAW. The EAW was eventually, the action the county took on the EAW was a declaration of significance requiring an EIS. That decision was appealed by the project proposer, again went to First District Court, and then eventually the Court of Appeals, the district court decision remanded the matter to Itasca County to redo the EAW. And really a large part of the findings of the court had to do with bias of Itasca County. And so the direction that came back from the district court to the Itasca County Board was to redo the EAW, to have the chair of the board recuse herself from any decision-making on the matter, and strongly suggested that the EAW try to shift the RGU responsibility, the responsible governmental unit responsibility, somewhere else, and suggested the Pollution Control Agency as the party or other appropriate agency. Subsequently, the county board did take action to refer the matter to the EQB for reassignment of an RGU to the PCA or other appropriate agency. And the at the same time, the project proposer also did make a request to the board to reassign to the PCA. And the neighboring landowners also requested the board reassign to the Department of Natural Resources rather than the PCA. So we, this is a first for the board, as far as I know, that there are worth three different requests coming to the board for reassignment. And then the reason for the tabling was that the decision of the district court was appealed by the neighboring landowners. That went to the Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals affirmed the district court decision, and then it was taken to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court denied to hear the request. And I hope the our counsel will correct me in my terminology. I'm somewhat loose in my legal terminology, so please do correct me, Leah, if you have some corrections. I wanted to go through the findings, and I'm not going to go through them item by item, but just tell you how they're structured, basically. And before I get there, I'll give a little context to that. The request, as other reassignments or designations of new different RGUs have come to us, they are under a specific provision of the subsection of rule having to do with responsible governmental units. And the full copy of the rule is in your that section of the rule is in your packet. The part of the rule overall is really trying to establish the ground rules for establishing determining an RGU. And the RGUs, the typical case with mandatory environmental review and EAW or an EIS is that the RGU is spelled out in the rule, in the part of the rule that covers the type of project that environmental review is being done on. There are cases, however, petitions where where there's some guidance needed for how to establish an RGU. That part of the rule, which is 4410.500, does provide guidance on how to deal with petitions. It also deals with instances where the rule is either not clear or not specified in the mandatory categories for when an RGU is what the RGU should be. And the general overall rule, we're getting called, I guess. somebody wishes to call in. The general rule is that RGUs are the agency, the entity that's either doing the action or has the greatest responsibility for approving the action. And then there are instances where you have multiple entities, and there's guidance in the rule for that. The last provision of this part, subpart 6, says regardless of all that, the EQB can designate an RGU based on expertise. So all these requests that we've had over the years, it's probably, I should count them up, eight or ten requests over the years have been using that provision, and this one was no different, except for the fact that the project proposer in the materials that were submitted to the board also cited another part of the rule, which is subpart 5, which is a part of the rule really designed to give guidance, again, when it's not clear what the RGU is through the mandatory category. And so it gives kind of a stepwise decision-making process through subpart 5 to determine what an RGU is. The project proposer's attorney laid out an argument in a letter that had to do with subpart 5. So what these findings do is first talks about the subpart 5 issue and tries to settle that question, and then goes to the subpart 6. So let me walk through this. I know it's a little vague, but let me walk through the findings. If you have the findings in hand, they're in your packet. Findings 1 through 21 are really all history. So that's just stepping through all the events that have happened up to this date from submittal in 2006 to the tabling of the matter, and then the removal of the matter from the table today. Finding 21. 22 really starts going through findings having to do with the RGU rule, which is 4410.050. 22 through 22 through 31 all has to do with subpart 5. And the things that so the 22 really lays out what was 22 and 23 lays out what was stated in the project proposer's letter and arguments that raised the issue of 4410.500. And and really part of that was acknowledging that although Itasca County has greatest authority under that part, that they've removed themselves from the process, and therefore, in the opinion of the project proposers, and this is in finding 23, therefore the EQB must determine the next governmental unit with the most authority. So that was an argument made by the project proposer that we felt needed to be addressed. So then the other part of the arguments made in 22 and 23 have to do with the fact that the Judge Maturi of the Itasca County District Court cited bias of Itasca County as a reason to remove the case from jurisdiction of Itasca County. And so that's another part of what was contained in the letter from the project proposers. 24 gives the language of the subpart in question, 4410.500 subpart 5. And then we try to walk through those. That's subpart in the stepwise fashion that is in that subpart. I'm going to take a break here and just say the Our assistant AG, our counsel here, Leah Hedman, helped a great deal with sorting through this because it was a more complicated matter than I had anticipated when I started this project. Finding 27 really captures the conclusion of the line of reasoning here is that, and it's not a conclusion, it's a finding, but where it says that first of all, in 26, it establishes that the applicable part of that rule, subpart 5, is in paragraph B, and it's where there are two or more units of government that have some jurisdiction. Obviously, the Itasca County has jurisdiction, but also PCA has some permits. There possibly are some permits through DNR, though that's not clear. And so it was clear that was the part of the rule that was applicable. And then what the language is that when there are two or more governmental units, it's the RGU with the greatest responsibility for supervising or approving the project as a whole is supposed to be the RGU. And so what we eventually arrive at in finding 30 is that there are multiple land use approvals that are given by that would be the responsibility of Itasca County, and that constitutes the greatest responsibility for supervising or approving the project as a whole. So that's really a key finding there. Another key finding is 31, which talks about the argument of perceived actual or perceived bias. And what we say there is that in subpart 5, we don't find any mention of actual or perceived bias in the rule in terms of a criterion. Neither do we find anything about the intent of the RGU to remove itself from the process. As you'll recall, the argument from the project proposer was that Itasca County wished to move the RGU status to another entity. But there's nothing in the rule that acknowledges that as a criterion for the board to make a decision. Actually, the board isn't really mentioned in that subpart at all. There is a provision at the end that the chair can make some decisions having to do with subpart 5. So in essence, when we get to subpart 33, we're getting to the point where we're saying really subpart 5 of that part shows that Itasca County should be the RGU. Then we move to subpart 6, which is what is really before us, which is the power of the EQB, notwithstanding all the other parts of that part, can redesignate an RGU based on greater expertise in analyzing the project impacts of the project. And so, again, it works through the matter that the matter was remanded to us, and so a new EAW has to be prepared. We have a finding that it's still timely, basically, because the project hasn't been started. And key findings here are 36 says that really just what the restates what the subpart 6 is all about, that to designate a different RGU, the EQB must determine that the designee has greater expertise. Subpart 37 also it's really almost the same finding as you see in subpart 31. It says that within that subpart 6, there's no mention of, as a criterion for the board, actual or perceived bias or the intent of the RGU to remove itself from the process. And I'm skipping through here, just trying to hit the highlights of these findings. The 39 really goes to how we establish this greater expertise. And And what we go to is really the statement of need and reasonableness, or SONAR, for that, for the equivalent section of the rule. The rules changed a little bit over time, and also, you know, this was the RGU was determined through EQB action on a petition. So there, the closest match is in the modern rule is resorts, campgrounds, and RV parks and shorelands. At the time the SONAR on this was done, though, in 1982, it was recreational development was the mandatory category. And the language there talks about how recreational developments are typically in areas with significant natural resources. They may have increased human activity and sensitive resources, often very controversial locally, and have significant impacts on local land use. And projects, and then again, local land use is mentioned again later on in terms of the activities that are typically associated with recreational development. And, of course, the RGU that was specified in the 1982 rules, that it was local government. So we see this as evidence that the intent of the EQB at the time when the rules were established was that local governments, this is the place for this type of land use, this type of project, and that the expertise lies with local government to analyze projects for local land use. And that's the finding then of 40, which caps it all off, that says, finds that Itasca County has a greater expertise in local land use. And also the case itself, the particular facts, history, and circumstances that the agencies like DNR and PCA wouldn't have. So from that, we have the conclusions of law that EQB has jurisdiction in two, that three, that the since the Court of Appeals remanded the matter, that an EAW must be prepared, that four, that the requests to designate were properly brought before us, five, that the county has the greater responsibility for supervising and it shall be designated RGU, six, that it has to do with the greater expertise, and then finally concludes that the Itasca County is appropriate RGU for the proposed project. Based on that, the order is to deny the request to designate a different RGU. And I apologize for going through this in this level of detail, but I feel it was important to establish the record for this matter. And there is a resolution to the effect of denying the matter in your packet. And with that, I will stand for questions.
John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I find it fascinating that everyone lacks confidence in Itasca County to do this environmental assessment, to revisit the environmental assessment. That said, I also am concerned that when it's obvious that this is a controversial project that's gotten a lot of litigation associated with it, that everyone wants to get out from under the microscope here, and I think that would be a dangerous precedent. So I commend the staff for analyzing the original documents that led to the rule that was put in place. I think that's exactly the way that in my history among various agencies we have looked at these questions consistently. And even though it's an uncomfortable reality for Itasca County, it is their job to do this assessment. And it is would be unwise for us to establish a precedent that because it's unpopular or in other ways difficult for the responsible governmental unit to conduct that work, it would be would just be dangerous precedentally to start changing RGUs on a some other basis. So I would speak in favor of the staff recommendation, and if you're so inclined, make a motion to that effect.
I'm wondering if a couple of motions might be in order here. One of them may be on the part of the board to accept the findings of the staff, and then the other one would be to authorize the chair of the board to sign the resolution from the Environmental Quality Board. Or do you wish to lump them together? I'm not sure how to proceed, legal counsel.
No, I think you can't be. It's probably need a microphone. I think it's probably most prudent to do it in two, so the board is clearly acting
yes.
with intent. So I think
so. To a motion to accept the finding of fact.
If Mr. there's Chair. No further discussion on
this. Yes. Before we get to that.
Go ahead, yeah.
Mike.
Just to clarify, the statute is it the chair. Or EQB that is?
According to the resolution on the last couple of pages, the sample resolution.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair,
pages of
Commissioner Rothman, I
should be a sample like this.
Yeah.
It's about 6-7 pages from the back.
I think what he's saying though, that the findings say EQB. That the order is
that you could
be hereby denies it.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Rothman, I think you're referring to the rule language. In subpart 5, that's a chair's decision. There is a chair's decision where there's unresolved controversy, it can be brought to the chair to resolve the controversy. In subpart 6, it's the board.
So are we acting under 5 or 6?
We're acting under 6.
That was my question.
So the motion should, John?
Mr. Chair, you're looking for two Brian. Separate motions.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
So at this point.
I think that, you know, obviously the chairman of the board is to sign the finding of fact and conclusion of law, and so I guess I would be looking for some direction from the board to authorize the chair of the board to do that.
Mm-hmm. So moved.
And there is a motion.
Second.
There is a second. Is there further discussion?
Just clarification, you are moving approval of the findings of fact and
Correct.
Conclusions.
And the,
that is
yes.
my second.
And then the next motion will be to authorize the chairman of the board to
sign the resolution.
Well, I guess that's what it is signing the finding of facts and conclusion in order. Maybe we don't need two motions.
It's safe to do two, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right.
So the first motion is to accept the findings of fact. Is that what I'm hearing?
That is correct.
Okay.
And that was seconded by Mike. Is there further discussion on the motion, Barb?
Mr. Chair, I might just mention, while I'm not here in a voting capacity, obviously, the Department of Natural Resources certainly is supportive of the both findings of facts and conclusions of law and shares Commissioner Stein's concerns with respect to the precedential issues here.
Thank you. Further questions or comments? Eric?
I guess I have a clarification question on the two motions. If we're going under subpart 6, understand that subpart 5 is a chair signature, and subpart 6, would that be a roll call vote if it's a board decision? It's just for my own clarification. I just want to make sure that we're...
Mr. Chair and Member Tomlinson, the findings of fact are for denial of the requests really under subpart 6, and the findings really reject the application of 5. So really what the only thing really before the board is and correct me if I'm wrong again, Ms. Hedman, but is the EQB designating under subpart 6. That's what's being denied here.
You're right. This is Leah Hedman again with the Attorney General's Office. It would be my recommendation that you would do a roll call vote similar to what is done at PCA board meetings as well. There would be a board decision that would make, and then the chair would sign on behalf of EQB as the representative of this board to the board's, what the board had decided. So that's what my recommendation would be.
Right.
I'm sorry, I may have complicated this by looking at a two separate votes. Maybe we can accomplish it all with one fell swoop.
Mr. Chair and members, the resolution does authorize the chair to sign the findings, fact, conclusions, and order. So it perhaps one motion would be sufficient.
Okay. Yeah. I would. You know, my point is that I would prefer not to sign it unless the board directs us to sign.
Correct.
It.
Correct. Right.
I think that's prudent.
I believe that's what the resolution does.
Yes. Okay. So on the motion, further discussion. Hearing none, we need
it is
a roll call
vote.
Bob, you can call the roll. Do you have?
Ms. Duncanson.
Approved. Yay.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Aye.
Okay. Ms. Knuth.
Aye.
Commissioner Napstad.
Aye.
Commissioner Rothman.
Aye.
Mr. Saxog.
Mr. Chair, due to involvement in this issue on a couple of levels outside of the EQB, I'm going to recuse myself.
Okay. Just note. Commissioner Stein.
Aye.
Mr. Tomlinson.
Aye.
Now, Mr. Chair and our counsel, Ms. Hedman, we have seven.
Vote yet.
Oh, excuse me. Yes, yes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yes, I did. I skipped you, Commissioner Fredrickson. Mr. Chair. Is that aye?
Aye.
Yes, we are good. Okay, that there are 8 votes in favor, 1 recusal.
And I'm also informed by legal counsel Hedman that we should have a motion to approve the resolution of the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board decision regarding the possible designation of different responsible units. Be it therefore resolved that Dave J. Fredrickson, Chairman of the Board, is authorized to sign findings of facts, conclusion, and order.
So moved.
Second.
Heard the motion. Is there a second? There is. Is there discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. I don't believe you need a roll call.
Okay.
You're good. Okay. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. I just wanted to mention, I appreciate the commending that you did, with, Commissioner Stein. I wanted to give credit to the tech reps particularly and staff for giving me a lot of advice on this too, particularly tech rep from DNR, Randall Donin, helped me through that and guided me to the sonar. So I wanted to give him some acknowledgement there. So thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Okay, the next item on the agenda is the eminent domain discussion, 473H. You'll find it in your packet.
After the rules?
Yeah. Should be here. Yes. Okay, Jeff?
Mr. Chair,
I'm sorry about that
board.
Smart aleck remark I made. You,
no,
you
that's
certainly
that's
not.
That's fine. But anybody who assumes I have a brain, I'll take it.
Glad to see you back in the
Thank you.
In the groove.
Thank you. This is a little bit of a curious situation. Doesn't come up very often. There's a statute that creates the Metropolitan Agricultural Preserves Program. The intent is to protect agricultural lands in the metropolitan area. Land enrolled in that program can only be taxed at agricultural rates, and it's protected from assessments such as for roads or other infrastructure projects. The statute itself I did include in the packet. Now, why are we even dealing with this? I'll get there. If an eminent domain action is proposed for 10 acres or more of land that is enrolled in this program, the agency taking the action must file a notification with the Environmental Quality Board. The EQB, in consultation with affected units of government, must review, as it says in the statute, must review the proposed action to determine the effect on the preservation and enhancement of agriculture and agricultural resources within the preserves and the relationship to local and regional comprehensive plans. Quite a sentence. A lot of things to consider there. If the board, the EQB, finds that the action might have an unreasonable effect on the agricultural preserve, the board would issue an order that says basically this action is delayed for an additional 60 days, and then it has to hold a public hearing on the topic. Northern States Power or Xcel Energy, depending on which letterhead you read in the application packet, has filed a notification. They intend to acquire 15 acres of land that is within agricultural preserves. I understand it's the larger property is 240-some acres, and they would be taking 15 acres of it. And so they had to file the notification. We received this notification and supporting information on February 8th. We had just a couple of days to put the packet together for this meeting, so we really didn't have time to review this topic or get you any additional information, and frankly have not really had the opportunity to do much research on it as of yet. So I wish that we would have had a little more information for you to discuss. But really where we're at is we're researching the topic. We do need to talk with the local governments that are affected, Dakota County, Met Council a little more, the township, the property owner. We'll be discussing this a little bit more with Xcel Energy. We will be preparing a resolution based on that research. Ultimately, if the board finds that there is no unreasonable effect, pass a resolution stating such, end of story for our involvement, it goes on. If this board decides that there is an unreasonable effect, then we would postpone, we would say you can't take this action for another 60 days, we would hold a public hearing on it and go from there. So that's really where we're at with it. Again, I wish I had more information to present to you. We have a stack of information. I wish I had better understanding of it all so I could present it to you, but that's the way it goes, I'm afraid. So really what I'm just asking for, what we are asking for here is, do you have any thoughts, questions that we need to pursue as part of the research, whatever input you might have, and that's about what I can ask of you right now.
Thanks. Thank you, Jeff. I believe there are representatives from Xcel here today, and if you'd care to comment, we would be most welcoming. Legal counsel. You're standing. That would be an affirmative then, I bet. Okay.
And the statute, Jeff, that you were referring to is 473H.15.
Correct.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair, members of the board. My name is Molly Smith. I'm with Frederickson and Byron, and I am one of the attorneys, along with Lisa Agramonte, with Briggs & Morgan, who helped Xcel put together this notice that you have before you. So basically, we came today in case there were any questions, and I could give you sort of an overview if you would like, whatever the board would prefer.
I'm just curious, you obviously have been in contact with the landowner, and are you at a point where resolution is imminent? Pardon the pun.
Chairman, at this point, we were going to end up in condemnation regardless of having this particular ag preserve. And at this point, I think it's a matter of determining valuation.
I see. Thank you. Other questions or comments? So, Jeff, we're in process then. Is that
we
correct?
Are in process.
Okay. All right.
And we will have a report, full report for you for the March 20th. Of course, they will receive copies thereof as well as the other parties involved. Of course, they will be welcome to present information to the board at the March 20th meeting if they wish to do so. And we'll see what happens from there.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I do have one bit of information I would be curious on is whether you could help us define what unreasonable per the statute means. I think the clarification I've received so far is 15 of 240 acres. Is that a correct number, 240?
It's 241, Commissioner.
241 acres.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering if you can, if staff can assist us in defining what unreasonable would mean in these, in this circumstance.
We'll do our best.
Would the term have something to do with where you draw the line? I mean, if you're going to condemn a chunk of ground, unreasonable would mean, you know, the little chunk right square in the middle of 240, whereas reasonable may be out on the edge or something. I'm just guessing.
That's as good a guess as any, I think. And the statute really doesn't give you any more guidance.
A former member of the legislature, I can absolutely understand why they put that language in there. Because they didn't know either.
Yeah, well, I would think a map. I mean, if there's a in the chairman's example, you know, if 10 acres of it's in the middle and 5 acres of it consists of a road to get to the middle, and that creates issues.
Right.
So a map of the project area and the proposed eminent domain area would be helpful.
Right. Ms. Chairman, members of the board, as a land use planner by, you know, trade, if you will, profession, I'm envisioning a series of maps showing this is where we're at, circling in, this is the larger property, this is the property being considered for, this is what he owns, so on and so forth. So I seem to recall Dakota County has a pretty good online GIS system that anybody can get into and call up properties and owners and things like that. So I've used it before. I'm hoping to be able to pull that sort of stuff together again. So you're thinking exactly the kind of thing that I'm thinking. Yeah.
Chairman, members of the board, just to let you know, the packet that we submitted has maps with it. This particular project is part of the Hampton Substation, is part of the CapEx Brookings Transmission Line project. So it went through the Certificate of Need and the routing process before the Public Utilities Commission, and those permits were granted. So we have maps of what was approved by the commission during those processes. One of them will show you where the substation property is. It's located adjacent to 215th Street East and Highway 52, so it's right in the corner of the parcel.
Becky Balk is here from our department and also has those maps in hand, I assume, but we weren't really prepared to put those on the table at this point in time. But Becky, if you want to...
Yeah, the maps in the packet show it, but they don't really say, okay, how much property does this particular property owner own, mm-hmm. things like that. And I'd like to, you know, clarify some of that with the information to answer, get a little bit, you know, I don't know if I'll be able to answer what reasonable is, but at least we'll be able to pull together what information we have. There are some very good maps in your packet, but there are some other things I would like to augment them with.
Okay, other questions for Jeff or Molly? Eric?
I do, and this is, it could turn out to be a silly question. This is the product of me reading things piecemeal here. But
we'll
I
be
do
the
see
judge of that.
Subdivision 10, it talks about when agricultural preserve ends, and I don't know if that's referring to... This is the first I'm seeing it. So if agricultural preserve is a program, a lease program that expires, and I'm curious when...
Oh, that's referring to the actual property. The statute does define what is agricultural preserve, and it is the property that a property owner puts in the preserve. So when they're talking about when does it end, it's like when does the designation expire, terminate, things like that. That's what they're talking about.
I guess then my question is, when is this parcel set to expire?
That's good.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you both.
Thank you.
I believe we are 1 hour early for closing time, so.
Good job.
We can make it to.
Little American Idol there?
Little American Idol, yes, yes, right. All right. Is there anything else?
Second.
No, I have a card. Anything else that needs to come before the board at this time? None, a motion to adjourn. Is there a second?
Yes.
There is. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Same sign. Thank you very much.
Thank you.